This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com. This podcast is sponsored by Genesis Aerosystems, a Moog company and leading provider of autopilots for rotor and fixed-wing aircraft.
The Genesis S-Tech 5000 is the latest digital autopilot, providing increased safety plus decreased pilot workload.
It's being certified for Part 23 and Part 25 retrofit aircraft, such as high-performance turboprop and turbine jet aircraft.
To learn more about the S-Tech 5000, visit genesis-aerosystems.com. This week on Hangar Talk, an electric aircraft climbs to new heights.
And a very light jet, 8 years in the making, finally makes its first flight.
Be ready for that ICAO flight plan.
And once you file that ICAO flight plan, Ian, be ready for the 2017 AOPA regional fly-ins.
All right, David, that sounds great. You ready to do Hangar Talk?
Let's do it, Ian.
Okay, David, first story, extra aircraft, you know, the super high performance
aerobatic plane.
Yeah, you got it. In this case, the extra 330LE, which
nice.
Is, yeah, one of their top of the lines. Actually, Walter Extra, the namesake, put a Siemens, they would call it.
Siemens engine, electric.
Yep, electric motor into that guy and took off like a rocket.
He did, 2,200 feet per minute. That's what it climbed at. That's a little bit better than the Cessnas we fly around here.
Yeah, it really is. So the whole point was a time to climb record. He went to what, about 10,000 feet in 4 minutes, 22 seconds.
Wow, that's awesome.
Which is really impressive.
That plane is impressive
it
in
is.
Any
beautiful.
Form.
Yeah, it really is. It's super cool. One thing that's interesting is, you know, people, I think, who aren't following electric closely, they might not have a sense of how powerful these motors have become.
Yeah. Can you describe it to us in terms that would like equate to horsepower?
Yeah. And so this is where it gets a little bit tricky. I mean, you'll hear people say the electric motor has so many horsepower, but of course it doesn't have horsepower.
Kilowatts.
But they do make horsepower equivalents. And in this case, I think, 260 kilowatt motor with a 348 equivalent horsepower.
That is huge ponies.
Yeah, that's a monster. Hey,
that is.
Yeah. So
it'll get up and go.
Yeah. I'm so excited about this stuff. I'm so jazzed. This electric. I feel like when you start doing things like time to climb records, that's like what people were doing in airplanes decades ago.
You're right. Yeah, some of the original pioneers.
Yeah, and so it feels like it's a new cusp.
We're on that same pioneering edge.
Yeah, that's right.
What's interesting to me about the whole electric engine technology that we're looking at now is that I really think that this could be a technology that would help students closer to the airport.
Yep.
I mean, you can do the high performance thing like the extra, and this definitely, proves that it can be done and some aerobatic routines as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, when you're trying to do a proof of concept and you're, taking lessons, I think it'd be a lot easier for folks to do and a little bit less expensive too.
Yeah. You know, the only real application that I think that I can't imagine electric helping a whole lot, even in the midterm, is maybe like corporate and airlines.
Yeah.
But for almost any GA application, I think it's far superior to a gasoline engine.
That's really interesting. We need to learn a little bit more about the backup power, things like that, because that's something that we always talk about even now with our gas-powered and diesel-powered engines.
Yeah.
But certainly breaking the mold on this bad boy.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's so cool to see people do this kind of stuff. So now people are doing longer flights, so they're trying to prove out the endurance, which is important. They're doing all kinds of different technology like plug-in or battery swap. And of course, there's Walter Extra, you know, shooting up with all that instant power.
You know, this plane to me is a little hot rod. And when I think of electric or battery power, you know, you and I both talked about this. I had a Prius for a while.
Yeah.
Do you have one now?
Yeah. Sure do.
So, you know, but
it's not a hot rod.
No, it's not. But you can still spin the tires on it.
Can you?
I did on mine.
Did you?
Yeah. But this kind of.
I have not tried to. But wait, was it snowy out? How did you spin the tires?
No, just you got to get in the right conditions, just like the right conditions for an electric airplane, you know, and it did fine.
We drive ours on eco mode. You know, it's got like power, regular, and eco mode.
Sure.
Yeah. We drive it on eco mode.
I gotcha. Well, you're doing good stuff for the environment. Yeah. But with it, speaking of the environment, something like this, I really see that it could be going somewhere.
Yeah.
And really help out folks who are just starting out in aviation and really the technology and throwing that kind of electric technology into an aerobatic airplane that has such pedigree.
Yeah. It's awesome.
Way to go.
Yeah, it's awesome. And one more thing, you mentioned the flight school application. You know, turns, flight during between lessons, turns.
Flips, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Quick turn.
Yeah, they, you know, now it's like you come down with the student, you got to refuel it, you got to wait for the fuel to come down to the sumps, you sump it, everything else.
Oh, yeah.
With quick swap batteries, it could be instant. It's like you go out to the airplane, you pull out the battery, you put in a new one, you're ready to go, just like that.
That would be nice, like clip it in and go.
Yep, that's it. And all of those training applications, it's like, when a student first starts, my experience is it takes them, it's a good like 10 hours until most people feel comfortable operating the engine.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. I mean, it's like, could you imagine taking 10 hours every car you got in to try and figure out how to operate it?
No, I couldn't.
Yeah. And so it's like to just show up at the airport, turn the key, and the thing just runs?
Until you get comfortable with it, you're right. And plus, of course, we don't know what a pre-flight would look like, but one would assume it might even be easier.
Yeah. I would think
quicker.
So. Yeah. Absolutely.
I know when I pre-flight our planes here, we have some Cessnas that are available to us in a Beach Sierra. I mean, even going quick, it takes me a while, and I don't want to go too quick. I want to make sure everything is checked, you know, grab onto the different, you know, parts of the plane, make sure they're not going to fall off and that kind of thing. But on an electric plane, I would imagine it'd be a little bit less to do.
Yeah, I think so. I know that when I pre-flight the Prius,
it's
only a minute.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Getting that Prius and roll. That was a great car.
It is
now,
a good
I know
car.
This is an aircraft podcast,
well, no,
but
it's
that was
true.
A great car.
It is. And it proves, I think, how, like, I remember when we bought it, I was scared because you think there is so much that could go wrong with this car technologically.
Uh huh.
And nothing has
Nothing happened to mine either. The only thing that I ever had to service was the regular battery that actually turned the car on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it would be like replacing the battery in your gasoline-powered car with a Sears, you know, diehard or something.
Yeah.
And I did that myself.
Yep.
That was it.
I know. It's amazing.
So the technology is stone cold simple once it's working.
Yep. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
Really cool stuff. So from electric to all the way to the other side.
Oh, yeah.
You teased this one, jet making its first flight.
The Stratos 714 has finally flown. And this is an aircraft that's a single engine jet. It has two intakes, one in each wing, but it's a single engine jet.
Hmm.
And it has been in development since, I think they took their first deposits in 2008.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah.
But it's coming to market soon. This plane is kind of cool because the service ceiling is pretty high. It's like 41,000 feet.
Yeah.
And that's where the commercial jetliners fly.
Yeah.
And the aircraft is badged a November 403 kilo tangle, like 403 knots.
Oh, okay.
But now the specs for the plane spec it out at 402 knots, the true airspeed. And about
maybe 402 KT wasn't available.
Maybe it wasn't. Right. I was wondering about that. I was getting ready to call the company and ask.
Right.
1,500 nautical mile range. So I think that their goal is to have this be an interesting, what we call very light personal jet that can fly up in the flight levels.
That's cool. Yeah, it definitely a long time in the making. They, if you haven't seen a picture of this, you can just Google it or go on to AOPA.org. But it looks like kind of like the Cirrus jet and maybe like a scaled composites airplane had a baby.
Combined.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does indeed. It has that same kind of swoopy looking front.
Yeah.
And it's a sexy looking airplane.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's interesting. The first flight, now every company, unless there's an accident, is going to say, hey, the first flight went awesome, right?
Right.
This one only lasted 10 minutes,
which
kind of caught
enough.
Yeah, kind of caught my eye. And if you read our story, Actually, I think it was maybe the CEO made a comment. Yeah, and he said, well, there are a few minor issues that were expected, nothing dramatic.
Nothing dramatic.
So that says to me, maybe not quite as successful as maybe they thought it was going to be.
Right.
But hey, got to give them a lot of credit. I mean, they built something and it flew. That's incredible.
They did, and he was still relieved about it. And I think that, like we said earlier, the first folks saw the plane back almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like 9 years ago now.
Yeah.
And the aircraft is priced at about $2.5 million in today's money.
Which, you know, it's a lot of cash, but for a jet.
It is. It is. Well, does that put it on par with like the Cessna Mustang?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit less than that, depending on how it's spec'd out. But
right.
Obviously a little less capability in terms of seats and everything too.
Right, so, it is smaller.
Yeah. So that's right about in the sweet spot of the market, I'd say.
It's an interesting concept. I'm glad to see someone, a group of folks taking the plane to market. And really, I don't know if our podcast listeners know this, but it's so difficult to get an aircraft or even a piece of avionics, to market
millions
these days.
And millions of dollars.
Yeah, and we talked about that last week and I think the podcast before that too. So more kudos to these guys and test pilot Dave Morse for flying the plane and Lynn Fox over there to do those high-speed tests.
Yeah, that's cool. Great. All right, so something else that's coming on soon here in the next couple of months that people need to start thinking about and getting accustomed to is this ICAO flight plan.
Right.
This is, to make a super, super long story really short, basically what's happened is FAA is going to ditch that domestic flight plan form. They've been talking about this for like 10 years, by the
exactly.
way. Exactly. And they're going to incorporate the ICAO flight plan.
And so what does ICAO mean? Is it just like international in scope? That's where it came from?
Yeah, what is it? International Civil Aviation Organization, basically.
So everybody's on the same page, just like with Zulu time.
Yeah, you got it. I mean, that's the idea. So that everybody can operate off the same plan so that when you fly internationally, all the controllers know what's going on and the systems can talk to each other and everything else. Have you done one of these?
You and I were talking about this a few minutes ago. I actually filed an FAA flight plan the other day to go down to Virginia.
Yeah.
And part of what came up on there were a couple of fields that I hadn't seen before. So it was sort of looked like it was sort of a combination. I did that on our own AOPA flight planner.
Okay.
And it asked me a couple of things I wasn't familiar with, like what kind of survival equipment did I have on board? And so then I started doing a little poking around, and the ICAO flight plan does ask that.
Yeah. Okay.
It specifically asked a little bit about what survival gear you have on board. You have four different kinds of survival gear that you could possibly have.
Really?
Yeah. I'm going by memory now. We're looking at I think that your choices are
Is this thing, it's like water,
polar, desert.
Polar, okay.
Or desert, or maritime, or jungle.
Wow.
And you just click a box
okay.
and say accept.
That's interesting. Okay. I'm not a survival expert. I don't even know what the difference between jungle and
well, what flipped me
desert.
Out was it asked me about dinghies.
Oh, yeah.
Now, they're talking about boats here.
Yeah, right.
and life jackets.
Yeah.
Actually, we kid about it a little bit, but it does have some very specific information on that. VHF, ELTs, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I believe it also asked about like a portable ELT, which I checked because I do have one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and like a little portable PLB kind of a thing.
Yeah. So basically more detailed is the idea.
Yeah, it looked like it is a little bit more detailed with that. And you and I were mentioning this earlier. It does go a little bit deeper into the aircraft equipment. I think that for our podcast listeners, that might be the thing that they need to get more familiar with.
Yeah, and I think in my sort of limited experience with the flight plan up to now, flying a slant, what we would call in the FAA a slant golf airplane.
Slant golf is normal. Well, yeah. It's common.
Yeah.
Very common.
Right. So slant golf basically just isn't good enough, I would say, for this ICAO form. They need a lot more detailed information about. Because it, you know, if you imagine that it applies to every airplane around the world, it's
right.
like there's all kinds of unique approaches that they need to know that you can accept, all kinds of different RNP standards and everything else.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and so there's all kinds of like en route GPS and terminal GPS different standards, and then I know when you start to get into surveillance equipment, a la ADS-B, there's all kinds of very detailed there. It's like what kind do you have, and
it does ask for ADS-B whether you have the 1090 or the 978.
Yeah,
Mike Collins would our ADS-B expert would be
yeah, right. He'd have no problem with that.
But everyone else is going to have to know by 2020 what they got.
That's right. So I think if you own an airplane, in my limited experience, here's the deal. If you own an airplane and you're using a flight planning program,
uh-huh.
You got to spend 10, 15 minutes making sure that you fill it in properly.
And the first time.
Yep, and that it's stored. And then you just file it just like now, and it's no big deal. But if you rent.
If you rent or if you, then you have, and you're depending then on the flight school or the place where you're renting it. And then as a pilot in command, you need to make sure all that stuff's working.
Yeah, that's right. I'd hope that they're going to, you know, provide a sheet that's like, okay, when you file your ICAO flight plan, your equipment is S/G/H/J, whatever the letters are. You know?
S is pretty standard. VHF radio, VOR, and ILS.
Yeah.
I think a lot of folks are going to have that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you go beyond that to your mode A and mode C, which is your transponders. And then you can dig into that a little bit more and go mode S, different kinds of mode S's.
Yeah.
And then it gets deeper and deeper. And then, of course, the ADS-B.
Yep. Yeah, really detailed. So moral of the story is that's going to change over, mandatory changeover, sometime in the first quarter of next year.
It's coming soon, so we got to get used to it.
That's
right. Might as well start playing with it now.
Yeah, I agree. And so you mentioned the flight planner. It's on there?
It is. It's on the AOPA flight planner. And I must say that we're not, I know we can talk about this in another podcast, but our flight planner has really stepped up the game a little bit. This is like a pre-flight planner. That's how folks should kind of use it. But it is on there, and it's on under when you do your own flight plan, if you're going to go somewhere, look on the left side of the flight planner software, which is technically a pre-flight planner.
Yeah.
And then go over there where it says brief, get your briefing, and then where it says file right next to it.
Yeah.
File is where it's going to bring up your FAA flight plan and the new ICAO flight plan data.
Okay, cool.
It's just that easy. It won't actually put it into effect until you hit submit, so you can play around with it now, get familiar with it, and look at the different things that it has on there for you. And then actually at that point, you ought to make sure you plug in your own information in there and just use the AOPA flight planner. It's really a good one.
Yeah. No, I agree. I've used it. It is great. Other options, I know that Garmin and ForeFlight, if you're an iPad user, both support ICAO, so make sure to put your info in there if you use one of those. The hard part, I think, is going to be when you call, you know, like calling.
Yeah, because we're used to a certain order.
Yeah. And so, and the you know, where the FAA flight plan form is like, what, a third of a page, half a page? It's like this ICAO one's like two pages.
It's a little bit longer. And I think we're used to seeing the different numbered slots. You and I were speaking about this a little bit earlier. It's like number 1 through 17.
Yeah.
And I know we've learned that for years. And then the ICAO flight plan info doesn't really have numbers on it. You know, it doesn't lead you by the reins through there.
It's definitely not as
easy. But it's very similar.
Yeah.
It's nothing to be scared of, I would say.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Great.
Nice.
Okay. So from something that's coming up to a passing, we have to talk about this week. Couldn't go on without doing so, even though I'm sure you've heard the news, that John Glenn has left us.
The last surviving Mercury astronaut, which is a shame.
It is.
But what a guy, and what a series of accomplishments he did for us, for the country, and for aviation in general.
Yeah, it is amazing.
So now, you knew that he was a pretty accomplished pilot before even he was in NASA, right?
Yeah. You know, I knew he flew in the military. Uh-huh. But in reading our story, I guess I didn't realize that he started taking lessons even before he got in the military.
That is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And he was a decorated war hero, too.
Yep.
So he had the right stuff way back when.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, a lot of those guys, a lot of them, you know, they came from maybe Midwest towns, and they were all, a lot of them had, you know, combat experience. And it was just something about it that's like that makeup, that sort of humble beginnings, but then this really exemplary service. It just sort of worked for them.
They went on to greatness, and actually he handled that really well. A lot of folks, you know, when you meet folks who are sort of celebrities and that kind of thing, and let's face it, John Glenn was because of all of his aviation accomplishments. But he was a very humble person, and also his wife, Annie, was famously known to be shy. And then I read deep down that she stuttered.
Oh, wow.
Did you know that?
Mm-mm.
So she was not comfortable around people, and then the family was in the spotlight.
Yeah.
And there's a pretty famous scene in the movie The Right Stuff where she calls him on the phone and says, "Hey, all these press people here, I'm worried." And she didn't want to talk to the folks, and he said, "Annie, if you tell them not to come in, they won't come in."
Yeah.
And so he was that supportive of her. She went on to greatness herself. This is really cool. She overcame that stuttering problem. And she went on to teach people how to overcome that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And that's so cool.
Is it James Earl Jones, the voice of CNN?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he had that same issue.
Oh, yeah.
And so she, I believe she taught him.
Oh, wow.
And he ended up being the voice of, this is CNN.
Yeah, right.
So, wow. So the John Glenn and his wife, very, very, you know, highly thought of folks in America.
Yeah.
And he was 95.
I know. You know, the one thing that got me is, obviously not having lived through this, I mean, I remember in detail, you know, how he went up in the shuttle the second time when he was in his 70s. But
77 years old.
Yeah. Wow. I didn't realize he was 40.
Oh, for the friendship missions?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Which is, I think for the astronaut corps, maybe.
It's pretty old.
Yeah, slightly older. So it is, you know, he had a nice full life even before he went to space. So.
Well, he did. And also, he was a well-respected senator on the Hill.
Yes.
A lot of my photo friends photographed him at one time or another, either during parades or on the Hill, and said that he was always very approachable. And it seemed that he really had it together. And by the time he did that one last space shot, it was a little bit controversial.
Yes,
because he was well-advanced, you know, age-wise.
Yeah.
But he powered right through that as well.
Yeah,
and so the Friendship 7 was his first first space mission.
Yeah,
that's wild.
Yeah, amazing.
And how long did it last? Here, I got the story up. Five hours.
Yep. Yep.
But its impact inspired millions.
Yeah, and incredible stuff.
Incredible. I agree. Totally agree with you on that.
Yeah. Very cool. Sorry to see him go. It seems like a couple of weeks now in a row that we talk about icons.
We had Bob Hoover pass away not long ago, too. Yeah,
and Arnie. And
Arnold Palmer, who was an accomplished aviator. Yeah, 2016 wasn't really good to us for our longtime aviators.
Yeah.
But their impact will be felt for decades to come.
That's right. That's right. So one thing about people when they pass, you know, you get to see different people in aviation essentially honoring them. And one way is, you know, they have photos of them, like of how they met them at an air show or something like that. In fact, I remember Patty Wagstaff posted a photo of her and John Glenn talking, and she said he was a fan of aerobatics and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really cool. And so, you know, air shows being this great way to connect with other aviators. And so that leads us into our final story, which is fly-ins for this year.
Oh, yeah. Let's do talk about the fly-ins. You know, we are building on our success. And we had 44,000 folks who have attended these fly-ins since AFPA started them in, what, 2014?
Yeah, that'd be right. Yeah.
So, and I've been to a few this past year and a half or so. And actually, I went to some of the summits before.
Yeah.
And I must say that the regional fly-ins for me as a pilot are the way to go.
Yeah, they're great fun.
It's a lot of fun, and we are going to pack a lot more into it. We're going to expand it a little bit this coming up year. I don't know if you wanted to speak about that or if you wanted me to roll with it.
Well, let's talk about the days first and kind of where they are. So four events this year.
Four events starting out in April 28th and 29th. And can I pronounce this? Camarillo, California?
You got it.
Okay.
and then things are really kind of jammed together. We've got September in Norman, Oklahoma.
Right.
Depending on if you're an OSU fan or an OU fan, could be a good thing or a bad thing.
Oh, that's right, because it's right during football season.
Yeah, and that's that rivalry there, and Norman.
Now, how do you pronounce October 6th and 7th in Connecticut, and how do you pronounce it? Is it Groton or Groton?
Groton.
Like au gratin, the food?
Yeah, right. But G-R-O-T-O-N. Yeah, Groton, Connecticut.
Which is a naval submarine base near there.
Right on the coast, that's right. Right. And then finishing up at Peter O'Knight in Tampa, which...
October 27th and 28th, not right near Halloween.
Yep. It's funny you mentioned summits, where we've done summits in the past.
I went to that summit.
Yeah.
In
awesome.
Tampa.
That airport is awesome.
Yeah.
Peter O'Knight is a super cool place. So kind of, you know, scattered around the country again, which we try to do. Yeah. And you'll notice, David, you mentioned 2 days for these dates. Typically, we've called them one.
2 days plus, actually.
That's right. So a little bit of a different format this year.
It's cool.
It is cool.
I'm excited to see this.
Yeah. So we're going to, and I want to stress, the core fly-in is more or less the same.
It is. We're going to learn about safety. Yep. We've got some education briefings. We're going to learn about equipment. We're going to have manufacturers there. That stuff hasn't really changed.
Yep. And you can come just on Saturday. It's a couple bucks for like lunch and breakfast.
Uh-huh.
And you can leave, and that's it. Or the exhibits are going to start earlier on Friday.
On Friday afternoon.
So come in Friday afternoon. The exhibits will be open. We've got the Barnstormers party.
Barnstormers party on Friday night is super cool.
Yep.
It's a lot of fun, a lot of camaraderie. It's where you make and renew friendships.
Yep. So you can come for that whole thing. Or if you want to get a little deeper,
right,
learn a little more, a lot of times these are going to be hands-on. There'll be immersive workshops all day on Friday. So starting around, I think, 9 a.m. on Friday.
Really get going with it.
Yeah, for a fee, they don't know what yet because it's going to depend on the workshop.
But it's going to be specific. The workshops will be very specific to that region.
Yep.
Like if you're near mountains, it most likely will encompass mountain flying techniques.
Yep, that's right. Or some sort of hands-on maintenance or
exactly.
Over water, maybe in California.
Or on the coast in Tampa.
Yep, yep. Right. So the whole idea is you can get really deep on that subject. They'll have expert presenters. And then, you know, it's like 6 or 7 hours or something of really good information. And then when the fly-in is over on Saturday.
This is the coolest part.
This is the fun part.
Yeah.
You'll hopefully, in most cases, get to then go take what you've learned on Friday and apply it on Saturday.
Like do a little group fly out.
Yeah.
To somewhere that's probably cool, fun, new, and different.
Yeah. And so we'll work with type clubs on that and other groups like RAF and American Bonanza Society and lots of others, I'm sure. To organize these different flyouts.
I think that's really going to be a lot of fun because you'll take that knowledge that you have, and then if you use it sooner rather than later, you're not going to forget it.
Yep.
And it'll have it ingrained in your psyche a little bit more. It'll be fresh, and it'll be a lot of fun. It'll be the folks that you hung out with, and you'll be able to do a little bit of flying with them too.
Yeah.
So I think that's a super cool idea, and the regional fly-ins were so popular the past few years. In fact, you know, we've had more than 6,000 aircraft at these fly-ins.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely surpassed Summit, no question about it.
It is just going to be super cool. I'm looking forward to it a lot. I'm really looking forward to the new fly-out destinations this year, Ian, especially learning a little bit more on Friday. There will be a paid admission for that. We need to remind our podcast listeners.
Yep, as well as the Saturday fly-outs.
Exactly.
But, of course, those are voluntary, and you can come. That core event has not changed.
It's still free.
Yep.
And,
so
you know,
come and enjoy that.
In several of the events I've been to, a lot of local people came.
Yeah.
It was cool.
That's very cool.
And they saw what was going on. They saw a lot of aircraft. They saw a lot of traffic. And they showed up.
Yeah. Yep. So we hope to see you there throughout the year at one of those four locations or at a future one in future years.
And also remind our folks that are listening to the podcast that they could nominate their own field.
That's right.
If they want to.
That's right.
Go onto the AOPA.org website and navigate over towards that community events area and select the drop down and tell us why we need to get there where you are.
Cool. Great. Okay, David. Now, to our guest, this is somebody that you spoke to. Folks probably necessarily haven't heard of him, but got a really interesting story.
Yeah, I spoke to South Carolina State President James Clark, and he came to my attention because he flew a Vans RV over Clemson Stadium, which is also known as Death Valley. I've photographed many football games there, but the James Clark led a formation flight before the national anthem there, and he led it in an RV airplane that he manufactured himself.
That's home awesome. Built.
And then I came to find out that he really has a ton of experience leading formation flights.
Huh.
And he's a
college president.
A college president at South Carolina State, which is an historically black university.
Okay.
But he is a big-time aviator and just a fascinating person to talk with. So we spent some time on Skype with him, with President Clark, and he was just a cool guy. First of all, tell us a little bit about what you do over at South Carolina State.
Well, a little over 100 days, I'm president of a university. I did serve on the Board of Trustees for about a year. The Board of Trustees and the previous president had been replaced. The legislature appointed 7 people as a new board to make sure that the university was successful in a particular turnaround and accreditation and other financial matters. We got past a critical hurdle regarding accreditation, and then we have a lot of things to do to not just survive as a university, but to thrive as a university. It's a 120-year-plus institution, that's one of the great institutions here in South Carolina and around the nation, serving a particular set of students. And we're having a great time now, you know, making a difference in people's lives.
And you guys are a historically Black university.
Yes, we're an HBCU. And as a matter of fact, once upon a time, I would say probably I was in the seat of being premier, you know, HBCU. We're not as at the front of the line as we used to be, but we're working on getting back to that spot.
Okay, well, you can probably tell from my accent that I'm from the South. I'm from Atlanta, so I'm very familiar with Clark University and Morris Brown and Morehouse.
And Morehouse.
Yeah, yeah. So now you are not only the school president, but you are also an aviator and a very active aviator.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how you got started in aviation, President Clark.
Well, since you grew up in Atlanta, I grew up in a small town called Quincy, Florida.
Okay.
It's near the Florida-Georgia border. And I ended up doing working on a farm. Mm-hmm. My folks owned a farm. And that farm was, we grew corn and tobacco. And my dad from time to time would hire crop dusters. Mm-hmm. And because of the crop dusters, as a little kid, I used to see them down low and come right up to the edge of the pine trees and pull up, go vertical, and hammerhead turn around, come right back down. And so I was really impressed by it. Now, my father was old school. And he was not so much into flying. He was born before Wilbur and Orville took their first flight. So his view of flying was, if God meant for you to be flying, you'd have a set of wings. I went out one time when he went to pay them, and they offered me a ride, and he said no. And so I think that made me mad enough to look into flying later on. And many years later, when I could afford it, I took flying lessons, and that's how I got started.
So you learned. So you got the flying bug when you were a child working on your dad's farm down in North Florida.
Yes.
But of course, like a lot of us, it took a few years for you to be able to save up to have the money and the time.
Right.
And so tell me when you started taking your lessons. About when was that? Either chronologically, when was that? What year? Or about how old you were? Or, you know, say 10, 20 years ago, however.
Well, after I'd finished school and finished undergrad and grad school, I was working in South Florida. And a friend of mine and I were sitting down, and she had a flying magazine. And she said, you know, I looked at it and I said, that's something I was thinking about doing one day. And she said, well, if you're serious, ground school starts next week, and I plan to go. And if you're serious, I'll sign you up. I said, what do you mean if I'm serious? Sign me up. And so my friend Brenda signed me up for ground school, and I did. I took it, and then that was, I think that was in 87. Mm-hmm. And I did ground school, passed all of that, and I said, well, I have a couple of years to go do the flying. But in 88, I got recruited by AT&T to go to New Jersey as one of their vice presidents. Mm-hmm. And time had slipped by, a year had slipped by, and you have 2 years after you do your written. And all of a sudden, I had a few months that I had to get it done. So I went into overdrive mode and got everything done except for the long cross country. Mm-hmm. And now think about this. In New Jersey, around November, it gets gray.
Oh, yeah.
And it doesn't get ungray and white on the ground until about March, April. So I went from November to April, not being able to do long cross country.
Oh, no.
And I went and did it in Florida later on. I finished May 1990. That's when I got my private pilot's license. And then some years later, in 92, I ended up moving to South Carolina. And there are a lot of aviation opportunities there. I later in 93 bought my first airplane. And then 5 or 6 years later, started a project building an RV. Ended up with a friend of mine, Patty, and I built an RV6 that we finished in 2002. And it ended up being the kind of the poster child at EAA's Air Venture this year, because it celebrated 30 years of Vans aircraft, RV6. And the one that was on the poster was my red and white RV6. Now, I happen to be on the board of directors at EAA, but it was not because of that. It's because they had done an article on me, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago. And as part of their stock photography, they're this kind of pretty red and white plane against green background. It stood out. It's an RV6. Just happened to be the right model for it. And I got shocked. They sent it to me in July. Sent me and said, "This is the plane that's been selected."
So that's a cool story. So you, yeah. it took you about 10 years to build that aircraft.
Well, that aircraft was built. Someone else had started the project, and then we spent another 4.5 years on it. So it is probably about 7 years of work was put in there. Okay. 6-7 years of work was put into the project. And then I started another one, which I still haven't finished. And I have a third one that I purchased flying, but I totally redid every wire sensor, everything on the panel, every switch, all of the glass panels and everything. I totally redid an RB-8.
That's a nice aircraft. Absolutely.
That's right.
Very capable.
And that one I'm doing, hopefully, in honor of the Tuskegee Airmen. Mm-hmm. I've done everything to it except for the paint scheme now. Well, there are two things. I plan to fly an original documented Tuskegee Airmen in it, and I plan to have it painted, in honor of them, to the precise colors and precise scheme.
Now, how many Tuskegee Airmen are left with this this day? Just a handful.
I really don't know. It's just a few. Remember, they're in their 90s.
Yeah.
Some years ago, I was the chair of the 60th anniversary reunion activity that happened in South Carolina because they actually did some of the advanced pilot training in South Carolina.
I was just wondering if you might end up trying to give one of those young men a ride later in their life in that RV-8 when you finish it.
Well, that's what I'm hoping, and I have one that's fairly well known. I hope that his health is holding up, that I'm hoping to fly.
Excellent. All right, let's talk a little bit more about your the aircraft that you flew over the stadium when you guys were playing Clemson. Which is not
yes.
long ago. So
yes.
Go ahead and set up that flight for me and how that came about and what it was like to lead that formation, I'm assuming, during the anthem.
That it's kind of interesting. Once I've been flying formation over 10 years. I've done a lot of clinics. I've done ground school at a portion of teaching the ground school portion at several clinics. And I've been up with many, many people first time doing formation, which is kind of a lot of trust and sometimes scary. And I flew with Team Aerodynamics for a while, which was the world's largest formation aerobatic team.
Okay.
So flying up close and personal, with individuals was no new thing, no big thing. And we'd flown, whether it was games or NASCAR or air shows and so forth, we'd done that before. So when it became public that I was president of South Carolina State University and we were going to be playing Clemson, a person that had flown with me who had been in a class that I had given training said, "You've got to fly a formation flight over Death Valley at Clemson. This would be so cool." And I said, "No, you got to do it. We'll work on getting everything squared away with Clemson." He was a graduate of Clemson. And then he started, calling other people, and other people that had flown with me stepped in and volunteered. So we had people coming from multiple states volunteering to support the effort, and at no cost to anyone, these are buddies, kindred spirits, so to speak. And my assistant here also, when she found out that I was flying, said, "Wow, it'd be great for you to do a flyover somewhere, and including a homecoming game at SC State." And we're planning that, by the way, for this upcoming Saturday, if weather permits and everything else works out. But the Clemson game, we decided to do it, and a good buddy of mine, Jerry Morris, a widget, said took on the task of filing all of the FAA paperwork, that you have to do, because the Clemson Stadium is of the size that has a TFR, it's an over 30,000 person stadium. You have to do lots of paperwork, and you have to have all the right credentials. So all of these individuals are fully credentialed, and so we did all the paperwork and got all that arranged and got all the timings and so forth done and the markers down, the geomarkers and the references on the ground. And we had to be time on target. It was 11:55 and 35 seconds to the last note of the national
wow.
anthem. Yes.
so you guys pulled that off in front of 100,000 people.
Yeah, well, it was probably 75 or so, 75, 80 in the stadium, and I don't know how many thousand outside, tailgating around. So there were a lot of people there watching it, and they announced it, and it was, I think it was a little bit of a surprise because you know, people say, what is he actually in the plane? Or, and then he's flying the plane. So what? He built the plane? A college president doing that? Wait a minute. You know, this is pretty cool. And I think the other thing is, though, that people say, you know, if they have a president doing that up in the air, they must be doing some pretty cool stuff down on the ground.
So it paid dividends both in the air and on the ground back at school.
The big dividends really is back on the ground. And, you know, it's something for the it gets people talking about school in a positive way. It gets the students, you know, the parents, the staff, you know, the faculty saying, oh, okay, this guy's about precision. So no wonder he's pushing us with so much precision.
That makes sense.
One other thing, I use that as a metaphor for teamwork, for high-performance teamwork.
Tell me about that. Tell me how that metaphor works.
Well, one of the things that I point out is that in order, when we were doing the formation flights and air shows, you know, we're traveling 200 miles an hour, 3 to 5 feet apart. And if you don't communicate well and understand exactly what the objectives are for everyone, and if you don't clearly articulate errors and mistakes, you know, when we debrief every flight, you have to, with open communication, then somebody could die. And so the notion of having open, honest communication amongst every member of the team, checking your ego at the door, realizing that it's not personal. It's about making the team be better, making it possible for there to be a much better performance for everyone as a result of that type of communication. Everyone knowing exactly what the total team is doing and specifically knowing what their task, what their part is, and making the big show, so to speak, be real and exciting. I think the same kind of thing applies when you're working in any other organization.
Okay. Well, now, speaking of a big show, now, what did it feel like when you were flying and you got down to that 11:55 and 35 seconds? And what were the thoughts running through your mind right then as you were getting ready to make that flyover?
Well, actually, the more of the jitters happens a lot sooner. Once you're locked in, you know, you're fairly comfortable, you know, a little bit of speed change, you know, you're watching different clocks and timers as you head it in. But the you're set long before, you know, you get there. I mean, for example, we have two-minute markers that we have to hit, and I have some variability in the first two-minute marker. But by the time I get to the second two-minute marker, I'm on a straight in, and about halfway in, I actually don't see the stadium, you know, because it's beneath my nose. And so I have a reference point out in front of me. I have a reference point on the GPS, and I'm looking at the countdown timers and so forth. And so, you know, maybe about 20, 30 seconds out, we call for the smoke on, and we just hold what you got, you know, at that point in time, you know, cross over and go a few seconds afterwards and turn the smoke off, and then that's when you breathe. That's when you exhale, you know, afterwards, after the smoke goes off. And then you wait until you get on the ground and hope. You hope and pray that when you pass over, the last note of the national anthem was happening.
I'll bet. Now, how many folks were in the flyover? You and how many other people? And what kind of formation were you in?
It was an eight-ship formation. Basically, it was a V, a VIC with the Stingers. And so it was me with one in close trail right underneath me, and three off each wing.
So you were number one lead.
I was lead. So that's what I said. And for that game against Clemson, who started the year off at number two, and we were in a rebuilding year. We had just sent four individuals to the NFL. We opened the game with the alpha bulldog leading the Tigers, so to speak.
Perfect. That's a perfect way to open a game.
That's right. And then I handed it over to the coach, and it was left up to him to win the game.
I see.
But I will say, we did come back with our band, the Marching 101, and dominated the halftime.
Excellent. I like hearing that.
You have to go
cool
see
deal. That's a cool story. Let me ask you a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of your aviation, and we're going to circle back to the beginning real quick.
All right.
And I know you're tight on time. But when you were just learning how to fly back in the 80s there, did you have any early challenges that you had to overcome? Thinking back as a student.
Yes. One of the things that I recall is stalls. And a lot of people have that with stalls. And I, one of the things that I've come to believe is it's a function of how stalls get introduced. And the way stalls were introduced to me, I think could have been done in a different manner. And so stalls should be, people should, an instructor should think about that, you know, because it's it should be explained more and done gently and shown how it can be done gently. And so you end up with this fear now of spins. Now, that's the other thing. You know, there's two different schools of thought. And one school says teach spins and spin recovery. And then the other one that says teach spin avoidance. You never, ever go there. The boogeyman is on the other side, you know. And so I think early on, with the right kind of training, gently working into stalls, and I've come to believe now gently working, you know, some spin training would be a good thing. Other than that, a little bit on navigation. You know, I kind of have a math and engineering background, so, you know, learning, but this is just before GPS is, mm-hmm. you know, are coming out, you know, the VORs and, you know, NDBs and so forth, and stopwatches and timers. But once the first GPS came out, it was like cheating, you know. You know, it was actually telling you roughly how much time it was going to be before you get there, and that you were on the right heading, you know. So that was after that, you know, it's navigation became a breeze.
Yeah, students like Josh Cochran in our control room have it pretty easy now compared to how you and I learned, huh?
Oh, that's right. As a matter of fact, I did a long cross country solo, took off late afternoon. This is up in New Jersey, and the requirements were with the school, flight school I was with, whenever you land, top off the tanks. Do not leave anywhere without topping off the tanks. Well, I land, and it takes the fuel truck a lot longer than expected to get the plane topped off. So when I take off, it's about sunset, and I have to kind of go over some hills up in New Jersey, kind of like mountains almost, to a VOR and come back toward, you know, head up toward New York City. You know, I was up in Morristown, New Jersey. So a lot of lights and a lot of opportunities to get lost. And so my flight instructor got a little nervous for a while because he realized that it was dark and I was not back. Now, we had done night flying, but I was having to do, you know, cross-check, VOR cross-check, timing everything, making sure that all the timing was right, calculating all that in real time, and ended up not a problem. But with a GPS, you just say direct.
Well, yeah. Were they getting ready to send the search party out for you, or not quite?
Well, he was just sweating. He hadn't gotten that far.
Well, I'm glad you made it back okay back then. So now that leads us to another good question, which is what were some of the hardest lessons to learn when you were flying?
Probably the hardest lesson. Well, the most humbling experience is getting a tailwheel endorsement.
Well, you needed that because you got the RV6.
That's right. And I started with an Aronca 7AC, Aronca Champ, and that'll make you humble because, you know, you can't stop flying it until it's tied down in the hangar, you know, put away in the hangar or tied down on the field. And I tell people now, if your feet are not moving, you're just a passenger.
Ooh. I like that. So tailwheel flying taught you a lot about aviation, it sounds like.
Yeah. That's, you know, those rudder pedals, they're there for a reason, you know.
Gotcha. So now, did you learn tailwheel in the Aronca, and then did you have anything in between that was tailwheel before you transitioned to the plane that you flew?
Went straight from Aronca to RV6. And actually, it was great because the Aronca made you anticipate so much because you put it in and kind of wait, and then you have to anticipate it's going to go the other way and put it in early. And but with the RV, it responded right now. And so you were anticipating with the Aronca, and RV was just right now. It's like, oh, this is pretty cool.
Awesome. Well, that might, let's talk a little bit about your favorite airplane. I'm guessing that's the one over your right shoulder back there, the red and white RV6.
Yes. That plane I've flown, that's the one that Patty, my friend Patty and I did, 1996 Papa Juliet, Patty James. And we finished it in 2002. It's flown as far south as Key West a few times, as far north as Traverse City, Michigan, which is basically to Canada, as far west as Yellowstone, which is almost to California, and lots of places in between. And Oshkosh, It's gone there almost every year of its existence, you know, many times. Let's just say 10 times, a dozen times.
Well, I'm sorry I missed you at Oshkosh this year, but we're going to definitely have to hook up next year. So we'll bookmark that on both of our calendars.
And it's done several trips to Triple Tree. You guys have been down there.
We were down there this year. Were you there this year?
I ended up being able only to get there for a very short time on the weekend because I had these other duties, you know, at this other place, you know, that was keeping me busy.
Your day job's interfering a little bit too much with your aviation.
Aviation style, that's right.
All right, so the airplane that you built behind you, you were talking to me just now about Patty Smith. Can you spell that name for me real quick?
No, it's P-A-T-T-Y, Gillis, G-I-L-L-I-S.
I'm sorry, Patty Gillis. Yes. And so now what's the relationship between y'all two and the airplane?
I was working on another project, and she and a friend of mine were working together on a project. She wanted to get into building, and so it was an opportunity to help her with a dream come true, and I found a project and said, okay, we'll do it together. We'll do this one quickly, and while I do some customization on the other, and we got that one flying quickly, and she flew it for a little bit, but I was flying it, you know, maybe 10 to 1, but her real love is boats, and so I eventually bought her out on the plane. And now she and her boyfriend now, I think, are traveling somewhere in the Rockies or something.
You know? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to circle back around with a couple of softball questions. We're going to end it up because I know you got to go.
Yes.
Hit me with about approximate total time you've got aviation-wise.
Oh, boom.
You can ballpark it.
About 3,000 maybe.
3,000 hours.
See, an RV, I have over 2,000 in the RV. And the RV6, that RV6 alone.
Wow.
And then I have time in RV8, and I have time in other RVs, 9s. And I've actually flown the RV1. I've flown RV1, I've flown RV4s, RV6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Haven't flown the 14, RV12. The only RV I haven't flown is the 14, which is the large side-by-side. I just didn't bother to fly with that. And I had an opportunity to fly to RB3, single seat, but I haven't done that. But once I fly to RB3, and I'll later get the 14, I would have flown all of the RVs. Not many people have done that, okay? And I have time in Piper, I don't know, 600-700 hours at least in Piper, and then maybe over 100 hours in Cessnas and then other miscellaneous planes. I guess that adds up to over 3,000 hours.
Awesome. So you've aircraft you've owned, you told me about the RB6, you got the RB8 right now you're telling me about. And what else did you have through the line?
RB6A, I was a partner in a Ronco Champ at one time, at a PA-28 Alpha 181, mm-hmm. an Archer 2 Piper, and I sold that. And I've flown in, you know, the larger Pipers and the Lancers and, the Bonanzas and Barons and so forth.
Anything without an engine?
Nothing without an engine.
No gliders, no hot air balloons, no gliders?
Balloon. I've gone up a balloon. I've done some little bit of balloon time. Yes, yes. Yes, I did. I forgot about that. Man, I guess the biggest plane I've flown is got some time in a B-17. Left seat before. You can't get left seat time now.
Wow.
Unless you're one of those people that with a bazillion hours. And I got a chance to do that, and Ford Tri-Motor, some right seat time in that. And one of the things that's on my bucket list, not long ago, I got a chance to go up in a P-51 Mustang.
Fantastic.
So instead of like 160 horsepower in an RV, it was like 1,600 horsepower, you know, in the Mustang.
It got off the ground pretty quick, no doubt.
Well, actually, but not all that fast, because you don't use that horsepower. If you poured the coals on it, you'd basically flip it over, but the torque and so forth. But, you take your time, you ease up. And once you're flying it, you don't fly it that much faster than I fly the RV8.
No kidding.
It's a lot of gas. It will go two or three times faster, but you've got to be prepared to write a big check for the gas.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha. Let's circle back around real quick and tell me if you can think back about your training initially and where you are now. Do you have any advice for flight students? Flight students, not necessarily college students at South Carolina.
Yes. If you're going to train, save up your money first. And my rule of thumb is try to fly at least twice, but no more than three times a week. If you fly too much slower, too much, you know, less than that, then you're always climbing back up the hill, and you'll spend a lot more money. It'll take you a lot longer. If you try to cram in too much more than that, then, you know, you're just rushing through it, and you can enjoy the experience. The other thing is respect weather. Mother Nature always wins. You know, maybe you can break even sometime and luck out, but you do not win against Mother Nature when there's bad weather. You know, and there's an old expression, it's always better to be down here wishing you were up there than up there wishing you were down here on the ground.
Amen to that. And I know you guys saw some heavy weather last week over in South Carolina because of that hurricane too.
Yes.
Hopefully you escaped that without any major hardship to your airplane or any of your buddies' planes.
No plane damage, lots of trees blown over, lots of flooding, power outage. Some people were out of power for a week, you know. Mm-hmm. But we were one of the first universities to get back up and online and get the students going back to class.
Good deal.
Maybe to their chagrin.
Good deal. All right, I got to ask you a couple of questions here, a little bit more personal nature. Can you ballpark me your age or give me your exact age?
63.
All right. I already know your occupation. We got your hours. Tell me about certificates and ratings, obviously.
Private pilot, instrument, commercial, high performance endorsement, tailwheel endorsement, FFI card holder, flight lead, is wingman and flight lead.
Excellent. Any multi-engine time?
A little bit of multi-engine time, but I'm not multi-engine.
Not rated. Okay. All right. And favorite aircraft among guests, like we said, the one over your right-hand shoulder?
I'll have to put that in the category in terms of the ones that I fly. The RB.
Gotcha. I'm in good shape. Is there anything that you wanted to comment to me that I didn't ask you?
From time to time, a couple of things. People that are interested in flying, some people say, well, maybe I always wanted to do it. It's never too late. And it's a lifetime experience if you go out and get a pilot's license, and you can do it. You can do it in 6 months, or you can, you know, take a year, or you can take 2 years, or take whatever amount of time that works for you. But it's something that will last you a lifetime, and it's a unique experience. It doesn't matter what you fly. You know, once you're in part of the band of aviators, you know, once you get a little air under your seat, you know, that's it. You know, you're amongst that unique group, that unique fraternity called pilots. And it is a wonderful experience.
Absolutely. I was going to ask you one more question about trying to tie aviation into South Carolina State.
Yes.
Do you guys have any kind of aviation program at the school? And if not, are you thinking about bringing something like that in?
Currently, no, but yes, in the future, thinking about it. Probably the major builder of aircraft has a significant facility in South Carolina, and primarily Boeing. Mm-hmm. And there's other aviation activity and aerospace activity, a lot of aerospace initiatives that are underway. As a matter of fact, I'm on one of the councils and committees that's looking at readiness for that. You know, educational readiness and workforce readiness. And I think there's a significant opportunity for SC State in the future. But, you know, we have to get our ducks lined up. But what we want to do is make sure that we provide the educational experience that leads to a significant opportunity for our students. And I have a particular bias in that area, and I have a few ideas that I think will make us unique.
Well, you're absolutely, it sounds like you're a builder with a lot of experience, a lot of engineering background, and you can share a lot of that with the up-and-coming students. And you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, that's the buzzword for the future.
Exactly. And we have a significant number of engineering programs, and we're looking as to how to tie that add a little spice to tie that into the needs and requirements of the aerospace aviation industry.
Well, President Clark, I appreciate your time today with us at AOPA via Skype.
Yes, and give my regards to all of the management crew up there.
Absolutely. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
So it's neat to hear. I mean, he's got all this aviation stuff going on and yet still running the university. So that's pretty exciting.
It's hard to do. I guess he's good at juggling events and juggling things, and just a fantastic flyer, and good to have folks like that in the GA world.
That's right. Cool. All right, David, I think that wraps it up for this week. Our editor is Austin Hansen. I'm Ian Twombly.
And I'm David Tulis. Find us at aopa.org/hangertalk or email us at hangertalk@aopa.org. Don't forget, we're now on iTunes and at Sporty's Takeoff app.
Right. We'll see you next time.
See you, Ian. Thanks.